Hello, my name is Chip Lang. You're listening to Total EM. I have with me today Tom Balga, and we are going to talk a lot about abuse and neglect. And I know that's the subject that we don't really want to talk about, but at the same time, we really need to have this conversation. So Tom, first off, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, my name is Tom Balga, and I work at Yale New Haven Hospital. I work in the emergency department there. I've been there for about 6 years. And I've been working with the child abuse team from Yale over the last 3 years. It's called the Yale DART team. That's DART is for detection, assessment, referral, and treatment. And we just celebrated our 50 years of doing service in this type of environment.
Now, if Yale New Haven sounds familiar for some reason, Kevin Burns, who's previously been on the podcast, has also been from that location. In fact, he's the one who kind of got us together to talk about this.
Yeah, absolutely. He's a great guy, very well-knowledged, and I'm glad to be doing this with you.
Now, most of the people who are listening here, they don't have any real program in place. So they're not in a center of, I guess you'd call it a center of excellence, where they've got all these resources right at hand. So there's going to be a lot of this stuff that in a rural and remote environment, this could be a rather challenging thing. And I think as a quick disclaimer to all of this too, it's worth noting that you really have to know your state laws and policies regarding reporting and how you do this, because it's going to vary by each location. But I guess, Tom, let's talk about kind of some of the basics here. This is something that's always a contention with some of the people I work with because they just don't understand. What is a reportable event? I guess the first part, what do I need to report versus what I do not report?
So it's a great question. The main reason why you would report is if you have a suspicion for abuse or neglect. You don't have to be able to prove it definitively, but if you're suspicious of abuse or neglect, then you are obligated to report that. And you're correct. Every state law is different, and it depends on where you're located. And so one place I like to start is the very basics as far as evaluating a child, and kind of a focus on the highest risk patients, which are infants. So when you're working in the emergency department or in urgent care, one thing that's very important to do is the basic stuff that we learned in PA school or medical school, and that is to take a good history and to take a good physical examination. Let's talk about history. So when a patient comes in and you're seeing them and you want to ask, you know, obviously, so what brings you here today? And you have to kind of go over, when was the patient last right? How are things different today? And kind of focus on that, like a detailed history. One thing we're looking for is sentinel injuries to children, and especially, like I said, infants. So you may ask, like, what is a sentinel injury? Well, it's something that is a suspicious injury that otherwise medically is very mild. And it's suspicious because it's something you normally wouldn't see in a non-mobile infant. So we're looking for like bruising, intraoral bruising, injuries to the mucosa, behind the ears, and also within the mouth itself with the frenulums, if there's any tears in that. So that means you have to do a good physical examination.
So to kind of recap here, because you mentioned a lot of pearls right there. So the first one, and I think is honestly one of the biggest ones, is the suspicion of. Doesn't mean you have to be able to prove it at all, which is, I think, something that a lot of people get tied up on is they think, well, I don't have any proof, so I'm not going to report it. No. It doesn't mean that you have to have the proof to do it. It's just simply the suspicion. Sometimes suspicion, it's one of those things that's kind of hard to then explain it when you're calling it in or when you're trying to do whatever process it is at your facility to report such events. But you know, there are sometimes those people you're just interacting with, and you're like, these parents or whoever the caretakers are, or in general, something's not matching up. Either they lack the basic understanding that maybe this is neglect by just simply not understanding how to take care of this child, or this is something where, you know, the behavior in the room just seems off. The kid seems off. The child is not acting appropriately when I'd expect it to be. And you know, this makes me think of something that I'd be worried for abuse for. You can have just that gut feeling. Now, again, sometimes not much may happen, but I've actually seen this before where we reported it after the fifth or sixth time. You know, Children's Division starts paying attention and realizes that, you know, we're getting a lot of these reports and they're coming from all these different places that something just doesn't seem right. And they actually do investigate it and find that, hey, there really is something wrong. Now, again, sometimes this is not going to be something that you're going to see right away, in that this is a very long, drawn-out process. You can probably explain that more, too. But this is something where you're probably not going to get the answer on day one. It's going to take some time, and it's going to take some resources, but you've got to report that. And then the other thing that you mentioned, too, do the injuries match what this kid's able to perform? You know, if they're the classic one I think of, and I think everyone's learned this no matter what school they've gone to, is, are you cruising for a bruising? You know, do you have basically that age where you are expected to have some bruising? If it's before that point, before they're really starting to move around, that non-mobile infant, that's a really high risk category that I think we tend to forget about without a good story.
Yeah, that's perfect. If they can't cruise, they shouldn't bruise. Let's just go back to history for a second. So let's say you're working in the ED and a patient presents to you. It's an infant, and the family says, well, you know, the baby fell off a changing table. Well, that's when you want to get to details of the event itself. So when did this happen? Who was in the room when it happened? Who else was in the house when it happened? So we know that if there's multiple care providers in the dwelling itself at that time of the event, the likelihood of abuse goes down versus somebody being alone with the child. So you want to have them tell you and describe the beginning of the fall, the middle of the fall, or the end of the fall. And they should be able to give you a lot of details about that if that's exactly what happened and they were there. Often what will happen is they will start giving you details about other things that really just don't matter. And then all of a sudden, you know, later on they say, well, actually, I wasn't in the room when this happened. And you kind of can kind of start piecing things together.
And with that, too, it kind of ties in with the physical exam. Is what are they telling you? Does this actually match? I had a case, but to keep details very broad, basically this kid had a fall in an older child. So, you know, it doesn't sound too weird, but the fracture pattern just did not match with what I saw. Now, if the parents had told me a slightly different story or kind of mentioned details a little bit differently, I probably wouldn't have thought much about it. But with the injury they were saying, and then you look at the x-ray, and these are two totally different events. So then you start diving into a little more detail and say, hey, I'm just trying to get a better understanding of what happened, because I'm looking at the x-rays and he broke his arm or whatever, but I don't understand how it quite happened this way. Can you give me a little more detail? And then it's like you said, it goes back to the history again. Sometimes you don't pick up on the history the first time because the story sounds okay. And we hear enough of these, you know, kid falls off of whatever surface, you don't think too much about it. But then when you look back and you see these injuries on your physical exam or on the imaging or whatever point you're at the visit, something's just not adding up. And I think it's worth noting that you can always go back and ask for more details. And I've also caught some parents or caretakers in general in kind of some lies where things are just not adding up. They'll go back and they, like you said, they'll start adding the details to the story that either they didn't want to tell you the first time or they were embarrassed to. Because sometimes, let's not forget, sometimes parents are just embarrassed. And once you kind of lay everything out, they're much more understanding. They're much more willing to talk to you about that. And you find out that, okay, my suspicion for abuse or neglect was a little bit at first, and then we started talking a little bit more. And realistically, when the conversation was finished, I realized, no, this is an honest mistake. And that can happen sometimes too. But usually we kind of err on the side of caution, at least in my shop, and we go ahead and if there's any real suspicion, unless we can figure out and everything makes sense in the end, we're comfortable with it, a lot of times we still will report it to some degree.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So there's a thing called Leventhal's triangle, and this is from Dr. John Leventhal from Yale. And he basically has a simple triangle that says on a one piece of it has to report, and the other piece of it is not to report. And there's a bar that's in the middle that kind of goes up and down. And that's exactly right. So as you're gathering information, your threshold to report or not report is going to kind of go up and down with the physical evidence, what other, you know, information you're getting from history or by other folks that were there. So that kind of gives you a lot of information. The other thing that you kind of pointed out that I thought was important is it's human nature to lie, especially when folks are nervous or they might not be documented or they have other things that they might be more concerned about. And so you have to actually kind of sort out which lies are important and something critical is being hidden, or which lies actually are not that important. And okay, well, now I have a better understanding of really what happened. The other thing I try to tell providers is when stories get to be very strange and odd, always keep that as like a red flag. So let's say you ask a family, you know, how'd you get here today? The ambulance brought us. Okay. Well, who called 911? Well, my brother did. So, okay. So you called your brother? No, I called my sister. Oh, so your sister called your brother who called 911. And so these stories can become, trying to give an example, very odd. And those are, you know, like red flags to be thinking about.
Let's talk a little more about red flags, because we already kind of mentioned a couple. I mean, the story just doesn't make sense. That's kind of a big one. There's physical exam findings that don't match the injury. There's also the lying is kind of, I don't know, do we call that a yellow flag, I guess? Because sometimes, like you said, there's sometimes reasons for it, but I guess to keep it simple, let's still say that's a red flag until you can prove it otherwise, until you can say this really isn't that big of a deal. But what are some other red flags we probably need to be paying close attention to?
The other red flags are actually parts of the social history, which is very important with this patient population. So one thing you want to do is you want to take a minute and look at the medical record of the patient and the family. So if there's a few elements of the social history that are critically important, has there been Child Protective Services involvement in the past? Because we know that 50% of victims of fatal abuse were known already to Child Protective Services. And right now in the medical record, you can find that information. The other thing is there any history of mental illness, drug abuse, and domestic violence? And the other one that's important is criminality in the household itself. So all those are red flags, and you can actually kind of quantify that to kind of put that together. But it's just good things to be thinking about to give you some more information about the risk to this injury and whether this is abuse or not.
You mentioned criminality. I think it's worth defining out a little bit more because it sounds like something that probably when you think about it for a second, but for the people who are driving, who are kind of trying to pay attention a little bit to everything too, let's define criminality. What exactly do you mean by that?
So if there's somebody that resides in the home that has been in jail, has a criminal record that you're able to find out about, sometimes this information is being put into the medical record. Sometimes this might be hard for you to obtain that, but it's actually criminality, anyone in the household that is where this patient is residing.
So far, we've talked about elements of the history, elements of the physical. We've talked a little bit about kind of some of your findings, for example, the radiological findings. You start seeing stuff, they've got some red flags, things are just adding up where, okay, I'm concerned about this. I think this is something that I need to go ahead and report. So what are the next steps to that? Now, keep in mind, obviously, again, there's going to be different areas with different policies, but let's say it's me, solo coverage, or maybe one other person's in the department as far as providers go, limited staffing. So this is going to be kind of a big ordeal with us because of making the phone call takes time and all that kind of stuff. What are the steps that I need to make? What are the things I need to do in general?
So it does depend on the state, but generally most states will have a phone number that is for hospital-based providers. And so that's one thing to make sure you have available to your providers is a quick, pretty easily obtainable phone number to be able to contact them. And then most states will also require something, a report to be done in writing. And what they most places will do is they'll actually match that handwritten report to the report that you made, you know, when you did verbally over the phone. And there's also a time period for that to be done. So usually I recommend that to be done, you know, right away. When a call is made, they'll ask you information about yourself, where you're calling from. And the big question they're going to have is what we talked about earlier today. Do you have a suspicion for abuse or neglect, period? And if you say no, then they're going to be concerned, like, well, why are you calling then? So just kind of expect that question. And then folks often ask me, well, Tom, you know, can you give me some advice of what to say to the patients, to the family members? So basically, it's important to let the family know you're going to make the report. You sit down and you kind of talk with them and let them know that you're really concerned because these injuries are more than you expect for this type of mechanism. And that can be a difficult conversation, but it's one you have to have. And if things begin to escalate, you know, you need to have sometimes security involved. Sometimes you might have to have your senior management involved. But these are difficult things. If you don't tell them, most of the time they can find out that you made this report anyway. So you really should just be upfront. And, you know, the bottom line is to treat patients like you'd want to be treated. If you're in that situation, you'd want to know that someone was making a report.
So something I just wanted to mention with that, because I know you talked about letting them know. This is a part that I think some people will debate back and forth, and one of them actually being my spouse, because we've talked about this before, and I talked about how in school they taught us to do exactly what you said, to tell the family that, hey, we have some concerns and we're wanting to make a report. And like you said, that can be a very difficult conversation. And her background is basically in this type of stuff. This is what she does. And she said, no, you don't make that. We at least don't recommend that you do that. You can do it if you want to or not. But they said, we don't recommend that you do that because at least in our part of the country, and it may be a little bit different where you're at, but at least in our part of the country, we have a lot of problems with, I guess you can say, disposal of evidence or trying to hide things that are going to be an issue, because a lot of confounders in our part of the country, a lot of times there's some degree of drug involvement or there's some other, like you said, some sort of other criminality going on in the house, that this is an event where if they know they're getting reported, usually Children's Division or Children's Protective Services or whatever you're going to call it, whatever agency is going to be going out there, probably is not going right away, because most of the time, if you have concerns that are bad enough that you're worried about the patient going home, most of the time law enforcement gets called, everyone gets involved, and we try and do that before the patient even leaves the department. But maybe it's the one that just the injuries didn't really match up, and you have some general concern, but you don't think that the child's welfare is in danger over the next 24 hours. Then they usually delay going in by about 24 to 72 hours. It just kind of depends on the time frame. That's kind of the general rough gist of things. And so they're worried about if you do report it ahead of time and tell the family that this is coming, then for a lot of your parents, this may give them some ease because they know this is coming in and they may not be too worried about it. But for the ones that there could be something else going on, that gives them time to hide or destroy things or, you know, kind of paint a perfect picture in a situation that may not really be that ideal. And so that's, I think that's the main concern with the main counter argument to that point. I just want to know your thoughts on that.
It's interesting. I mean, that's an interesting perspective. And I could see, I mean, I think it's a valid point, but you know, I still try to treat folks as I would want to be treated. And if I was a family member that a PA or a doc was going to make a report, that's how I would want it done. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good point, and you could probably have a whole podcast on just debating that one point. So it is interesting. But we tend to report all of these, and you know, for our institution, we really haven't really kind of withheld that on purpose, except for safety. We've had situations where they had no security, and that was like maybe one reason why not to let the family know you're going to make a report.
Now, something else that you mentioned, and I just want to cover this as well. You talked about how a lot of times they can figure this out. Now, at least in my state and other states I've been in, you are an anonymous reporter. Now, technically, when you do reporting, when you're a mandated reporter, you still have to give all your information, but that information is not supposed to be passed on to that family. Now, they can figure it out, especially if you told them that, hey, I'm going to report you. But there are definitely those times when they've interacted with enough people and enough has happened that they probably know which hospital it was that reported them, but they may not necessarily know who is the individual. Now, I've actually had this happen before where a caseworker disclosed my name, and that was a pretty big deal because that's something that's protected by law. But most of the time, and really the way things are supposed to happen, at least in my state, and again, it may vary by state, is they're not supposed to give that information. But like you said, sometimes they'll still figure it out because of something that happened or details that they only gave you versus other people. So, I mean, it still happens that way too. I think it's just kind of worth specifically saying that you are, in most cases, protected by anonymity.
One thing I did want to mention was to talk about a little bit about physio exam, because I think there's some stuff that the frontliner providers would be helpful for them. And I want to talk about bruising a little bit, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
So there's an acronym that was made by Dr. Mary Clyde Pierce, and she's did extensive amount of research on bruising in infants and child abuse, and looking at folks that were abused and folks that they knew were not abused, and kind of risk stratified them and tried to get an idea of where the bruising was for both those categories. And so she came up with this thing called 10-4 phases. And so it's T-E-N, the number 4, and faces. So T would be for torso. So any bruising on torso for any children under the age of 4, and any bruising on a body for any children under the age of 4 months. So T for torso, E for ears, like the pinna, especially the lower part of the ears, behind the ears. The next is neck, any bruising on the neck. And again, the 4 is for 4 months of age, any bruising at all, anywhere on the body. And then the torso, ears, and neck for underneath, under the age of 4. And so when we talk about the bruising of, let's say, the ears, so that's why it's really important to actually look at the ears, look at the back of the ear, look behind the scalp and the posterior aspect of the neck, and really take a good look at that part of the skin. So you want to make sure that these children are all in like a Johnny coat or a gown so you could really evaluate them. One thing we've done at Yale is all children 6 and under, we get them into a gown or a Johnny coat. And this way we really have the ability to really take a good look at their skin. And I think that's like one big pitfall for a lot of EDs is they're not getting kids changed. And same thing with urgent care. They're not really taking a good look at the skin. And also within the mouth itself. So you want to look at all 3 frenulums. There's actually 3 of them, and take a good look at them. There's a couple different tricks to be able to visualize them. Sometimes you might want to come from the top of the head down and kind of look at it that way. Like you're almost like intubating the child with a tongue blade to look in that area. You want to look at the eyes, make sure they close their eyes, look for any bruising of the eyes, around the eyes, and also any subconjunctival hemorrhage is another thing. Hopefully that's kind of clear. So 10-4 phases is a good acronym to kind of remember. F is for frenulum. Like I mentioned before, there's 3 of them. Auricular, anything around the ears. Cheek is the C, and that's actually the soft part of the cheek. And E is for eyelids, like we talked about, and also sclera, subconjunctival hemorrhages is what you're looking for. And then we can talk a little bit about biomechanics of a fall and something to kind of really kind of consider. So let's say you have a child falls down 5 stairs. A young child, let's say a 1-year-old falls down 5 stairs. It's a relatively simple fall. And it shouldn't have multiple severe injuries, right? So if you look at how humans fall in general, most of the time the impact and all the energy is on the first aspect of the fall. So when you see a child that comes in with severe multiple injuries, that's pretty high impact, and it's not going to be from a simple mechanism.
Do you have roughly a height that you tend to use where you say it's more, or is it kind of more tied in with the mechanism? Like if you fall down, like say the top of a staircase, is that going to be a little different versus a straight drop from 5-6 feet when child falls off the monkey bars, for example?
Yeah, even in both those situations where you fall down, even multiple stairs and falling off of monkey bars, usually that is one side or the other, one type of fracture. And it shouldn't be bilateral fractures, bilateral bruising, multiple areas. You shouldn't have complex injuries for simple events.
I like that. That's a great simple way to summarize that kind of key point there. Now, speaking of key points, so we've hit a lot of topics today on this. Are there some other things you want to talk about too?
Other injuries to be thinking about in relations to child abuse in infants specifically that are definitely red flags as far as injuries. A good take-home message is any infant with a long bone fracture, skull fractures, rib fractures specifically, intracranial injuries, and burns should at least give you a pause to kind of think, like, is this abuse or neglect? And what's been going on with this patient, because those are high-risk injuries. And here at Yale, those are all what we consider referral injuries, meaning that we wouldn't necessarily report that to DCF, but we would get other folks involved and really explore and make sure that this is not abuse or neglect.
Something we didn't talk about, I think it's worth adding this in just real quick because it ties in kind of with this picture, is when you do the history, try not to ask leading questions. This is something where you kind of just want to leave it broad. Just tell me what happened. You know, something just simple like that. And this is something we should be doing most of the time anyway, but you really want to avoid the leading questions. You don't want to ask them something that's going to lead them to a specific answer. Because sometimes that you'll actually trip someone up into that. They'll think that's the answer you want. And they didn't mean to lie, but they thought that's what you wanted to hear. So they say that. Or they are going to say a certain thing because they realize that, you know, again, this is kind of what you're looking for or what you're trying to not look for, and they'll change their story for that. So just ask them, you know, straight, simple questions. Just tell me what happened. Those open-ended questions seem to help a lot better.
Definitely, because we do see that where folks will lead them on and give them an idea about what to say. Oh, they fell off a changing table, right? And like, no, just ask them, so what brings you here today? When was the child last, right? Who was there? Who called 911? I mean, the families, when you start asking these questions, obviously they could get a little protected and be wondering why you're asking these questions. But you know, I just tell them, you know, just interested, make sure that the child's okay. And I'm concerned that the baby's injuries, and kind of go from there.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Tom, for coming on and talking about this. There are obviously certain details we could probably do a deeper dive on, and maybe we'll get the chance to do that some later time. But I just want to make sure before we wrap this up, do you have any kind of other final points?
Continue to, you know, be aware and be thinking about abuse and neglect. Make sure you're doing a good physical exam and as well as taking a good history. And don't forget about the social history.
All right. Well, in that case, Tom, can you go ahead and give us the tagline, please?
Until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.